it even better about your mother.
We'll call to order the House Revenue Committee this morning. Welcome everybody here. It's funny. To this last day to get some hearings in. We've got some hearings with testimony coming in. Others will be tap-tap. We'll go through these as expeditiously as we can. Let's see, I want to make a note to myself here. Okay, we'll begin with a public hearing on House Bill 3079. Who's here on that? I say that, but wait a second. Then, let's not then. If we've got Representative Nolan here, let's do 45. HJR 45. Yeah, since you are here, I thought we had a member signed up on the other, but okay. Well, yes, that's right. Thanks. Open the public hearing on HJR 45.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your attention on this.
Do you want Madison to give the report, or do you want to give the report? That's okay.
As you wish. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, the House Joint Resolution 45 is a constitutional amendment that deals with two subjects. First, it changes certain definitions on the requirements for the education from the uniformity, if you will, in the education in the general system, and defines or leaves to be defined by the Legislative Assembly later on, but it introduces the concept of the basic education and that to be the requirement that is needed to be supported by the state, and then above and beyond this level of basic education would be the local option. It also gives a temporary change and increase until the year 2007 in some of the taxation level on property. It puts back in the real market value a level of taxation for education that includes K through 12 ESDs and community colleges, a level that to be determined by the districts after they consult with or take it to their votes. Of course, the level that is inserted here is above the 85,000 threshold of real market value for property. It also increases on the assessed value of Measure 50, the increase from 3% per year to about 6%. And all these changes are sunsetted, as I mentioned before, on January 1st, 2007. It's not very clear to me, however, whether after the 6%, do we go back to the 3%, or does it stay 6%, and we take from that point on in. All these, of course, revisions are introduced to the Constitution as Article 11, Section 11K and Section 11L, and both those sections are sunset on January 1st, 2007.
Okay. Now, Representative Nolan, good morning and welcome to the House Revenue Committee.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for jumping the gun.
Right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your attention to this. House Joint Resolution, which I bring to you with the support of Representative Backlund, is part of a two-piece proposal to address education funding in Oregon. We bring this to you starting from the premise that a strong and prosperous economy relies on a successful, high-quality education system for its youngest citizens as well as its citizens prepared to move into adult citizenship and workforce participation. This package of proposals relates to both K-12 educational excellence as well as higher ed, particularly as it relates to community colleges. If I might briefly describe the companion piece so that you have a context. The companion piece is under review by the House Education Committee. We have had a public hearing on it. The companion piece, as your staff has already identified for you, asks that we establish a common definition around the state of a basic education. You are all familiar with the quality education model that the legislature has adopted and, in fact, that the voters of Oregon have adopted and incorporated into our Constitution. That defines high-quality education and, I believe, speaks to what we all hope our educational system in the state to be able to deliver. The hard reality is that we are not delivering that level of education now, and we may not, at the state level, be in a position to deliver that quality level of education in the very near future. So the package of proposals that Representative Backlund and I have before the legislature, part of it here and part of it in education, sadly recognize that potential. And they bring forward the question of defining a basic education that we truly do guarantee to all Oregonians. Statewide, consistent, equitable in every community and every district. That is in the House bill in the Education Committee. We don't want to give up on the prospect, promise, and in fact, I believe, the need to deliver a truly quality education. And in order to get there, we bring the resolution that is before you today. The resolution basically says that beyond a basic education that is provided and guaranteed to every community, every student around the state, communities may wish to supplement that. And I choose my words carefully because I don't want to give the impression that the supplement would necessarily be a higher level or a greater than, but it may just be different. It may have elements of exceeding or improving upon the basic level, but it may also just be augmenting. For example, there are communities in our state that may, because of their local industries, have a very high interest in technology education, computer literacy, and may want to augment or supplement the basic education with training in computer sciences or technical areas of design and things like that. House Joint Resolution 45 would permit that and particularly would permit those local districts to raise additional revenue at the local level to support that augmentation of the basic education. There may be other communities in the state where the highest the interest of their community because of their either their local industry or some other preference is that they would like to emphasize natural resource education or natural resource management or agriculture or something like that. So that it could be different without making a judgment as to whether one is higher than or less than the other. They're just different. House Joint Resolution 45 would propose actually a revision to the Constitution, and I want to make sure that that is clear because The judgment of Ledge Counsel is that it may address more than a single subject. To allow local school districts, cities, counties, community college districts, ESDs, to provide funding for that augmentation beyond a basic education through ad valorem taxes, and specifically authorizes, if the voters approve, subject only to local voter approval, a local governing body could not do it absent a vote of the local voters, to exceed the limits currently in place in our Constitution brought to us by Measures 5, 47, and 50. I also do want to point out, as your staff has pointed out, that any such additional ad valorem taxes that the voters impose would be on values in excess of $85,000 per piece of property. That exemption applies both as a homestead exemption for residential property and also as a small business exemption for commercial and industrial property. The first $85,000 of value would be exempt from any additional ad valorem taxes, so that we are not imposing an undue burden on either residential property, homeowners, or apartment renters at the lowest end of the economic scale, nor on businesses that are small businesses and operating on relatively limited property. That is the concept. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I say, I bring this to you to provide an opportunity for communities in Oregon to preserve the integrity of their economy and their ability to attract and retain employers in their community, and also their ability to develop productive citizens in their community who are truly engaged in both the economy and the community of their local towns. And I urge you to keep this measure alive.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Representative Nolan? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, thank you for bringing this to us. My question focuses primarily on the issue of equity. You mentioned that more dollars wouldn't necessarily mean better. It would mean different. Mm-hmm. And I guess I have a hard time envisioning that, but I would be interested in how you see this not even more separating the haves and the have-nots in regards to communities and districts and educational opportunity.
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson. I would like to see the quality education model implemented statewide so that every single K through 12 school district in the state has the capacity, the management structure, the teaching staff to deliver every single one of the educational achievements that that model represents. We are not there today. I don't think we will get there in this legislative session. And if we don't get there, I believe that equity demands that we define a floor that is consistent statewide. And therein is the equity element of this package. Unfortunately, I think the structure we have now doesn't really provide an equitable distribution of educational opportunity for Oregon students, and it puts an artificial brake on the willingness of individual communities to sacrifice and do something different for the community colleges in their local areas, as well as the K through 12 system in their local areas. And this measure gives them an opportunity to make those sacrifices.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, to the extent that this is a local option or proposes a local option, I know in the other conversations we've had, both on this end and down at the Senate, we've had pretty strong opposition expressed by OEA and COSA in particular to local option efforts. Have you had any response from them to this proposal?
Mr. Chair, I have had some conversations with the education advocates and representatives. They would prefer a different end result, but they also acknowledge that their preferred option may not be the one that is still standing when we sine die. And so they're interested in this proposal.
But they haven't given you the checkbook to run this campaign either.
Not yet.
Okay. All right. Other questions for Representative Nolan? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Have you considered separating the pieces of this to the extent that it might not become a revision? Let me be more specific. It seems to me, if I've read the summary correctly, that you're really addressing two different issues. The first one is the one that you spent most of your time talking about. And the second one is the issue of how a local election would be conducted and what kind of vote totals would be needed in order to pass a measure. And it occurs to me, and this is another practical question, it occurs to me that it might make sense to separate those two issues into separate measures. It might also get you past the Armada problem. I don't know if you've thought about that.
Of course, you're proposing this as a revision, so that takes care of Armada if you get two-thirds vote in both houses.
That's right.
Correct.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart.
If I could add to the question, then, there's one other aspect to this. In a campaign to pass a measure like this, there may be some people who would oppose it because of the piece that is because of the second piece, mm-hmm. who might otherwise support it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, there are any numbers of ways to skin a cat.
Yeah.
The fact that we have chosen a revision here suggests, and this would be a correct interpretation, that we would prefer one conversation about the issue
right.
rather than the challenge of having to run multiple measures, which can be just as confusing and just as distracting from the desired outcome of a successful campaign.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you for your attention.
Does anybody else wish to testify on HG? Brian, let me recess. Because we've got a couple members here I want to get to, so I'll make a note to come back to 45. I recess the public hearing on HJR 45. Representative Crummell, you're here on 2819. Let's go ahead and open a public hearing on that. Take your testimony, then we'll recess that. And Representative Morgan, you are here on 2923. Gotcha. Okay. Public hearing, then we'll open that on House Bill 2819. Representative Crummell.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. For the record, I'm State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26. I want to thank you for having a hearing on House Bill 2819. This is a policy choice that I think we as a legislature can meet and provide some flexibility and some flexibility for both the parent, the student, as well as the school district. Or school districts, I should say. This concept was brought to me by the former chair of the Westland Wilsonville School Board, and we actually had introduced this in the 01 session, and so it's back for a rerun. The concept that we're trying to get to here is to stop paying for seat time in our schools and help our students actually attain the type of education that they would like to attain. And I think even with the 21st century schools plan that was passed in the early 90s, that we still find ourselves in a situation where we are, in fact, paying for seat time, and student, there is still a certain amount of social promotion that occurs. And what this bill is aimed at doing is really helping the student get to the provider that's going to give them what it is that they need in terms of a rounded education. This is going to give us the opportunity then to pay for a very meaningful education for the students. And it would be helpful to programs such as the Oregon Army National Guard Youth Challenge Program. Now, the other day we had a hearing in general government about that very program, and what they would like to do actually is take is put that program as part of the state school fund. But what this type of a plan could do in 2819 would be to enable us, because of the way it's structured, that the students, when they go to the Oregon Army National Guard Youth Challenge Program, as an example, the part of the money that would be paid to their school district actually is going to follow them. And so the cost of having them go through a program such as the Oregon Youth Challenge Program, that helps kids that have become a little bit dissident and maybe aren't performing the way that they should, help them get to the point that they should be in. This will also allow the parent and student to have flexibility in their own education program, so that if they don't feel that their local district is meeting their needs, they're going to be able to go to a district and receive the type of education and type of programming that they find most helpful to them in getting them down the road to where it is that they're trying to go. I would just point out a couple of features of the bill. On September 1st of each year, a parent or guardian would have register their child with their resident school district, and then the money from the state school fund would go to the resident school district for that child's education. Then and it would be based on the current ADMW that we have. And then in addition to that, what it would allow is that it would allow for the student and the parent to determine if they felt that they weren't getting what they needed from that particular district. It would enable them to transfer to another district or another school, or, for example, the Youth Challenge Program, and 80% of the dollars would travel with them to the alternate program. The resident school district for administering and still being responsible for that child's records and that sort of thing would retain the 20% of the state school funds for them to handle those administrative costs. That, in a nutshell, Mr. Chair, is the crux of 2819. I do know that there is a -1 amendment, and whether you do it now or recess and then come back to this bill, there is a -1 amendment that's being proposed by Representative Zahner, and his staff is here to talk about that. And the amendment does have my okay. I'm aware of it. I've read it. I'm in agreement with it. So I don't have a problem with the amendment in that respect at all. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions. I thank you again for hearing this bill. I would encourage the Revenue Committee to look at it very carefully and consider the policy that's here, as well as the overall concept itself. And hopefully, we could move this bill on through the process.
All right, questions, Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Krummel, maybe I'm confused about it, but I need you to straighten me out here. In Coos Bay, you can live in Coos Bay, but your student may go to North Bend, or you can live in North Bend, and that student can go to the Coos Bay school, or you can live in either one of those, and the student can attend the community college. Now, this is with the consent of the school districts, and money does follow the student. So I'm wondering how that's different than the bill, but what the amendment does, it says they may move without the consent. Now, that would be different than in my district. But is
that not the case all over the state? Can students not go to other schools? The only school that my child could not attend and money would follow would be to Christ Lutheran. That would be a private education, and the parent would have to pay. So I'm confused. What is different about the bill, and what is happening in my district?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Verger. Thank you for the question. I think that's a very good question. Currently, school districts do have a choice. If a student applies to go outside of the district for whatever reason, the resident district can choose to ignore the application or decline the application, I should say. If the district says, well, you know, we send 35 of our students a year to this particular district, but we only get 5 back, so we're losing money, so we'll let them go, but we're not going to send the money. Now that's a decision that Westland Wilson Middle Schools has very recently made, that if a student transfers out of the district, that they may allow them to transfer, but they're not going to send the money with them. So it would be up to the student's parents then to pay tuition to the new district. So there is the ability of a district currently to be able to decline an application in that respect. The other aspect is that right now it takes the approval of the district. And what 2819 originally was designed for is to try to bring the parent, the student, and the district together in terms of deciding what's going to be best for that particular student. And with the amendment, if the district said no, they did not want to allow the transfer or weren't going to approve the transfer, the student and parent could still say, no, we still think that it's best for Susie to go to North Bend as opposed to Coos Bay, and therefore we're going to move her. And then with the 2819 the way it is, the dollars, 80% of the dollars would then transfer to the school district that's providing the services.
Yes, sure.
So in other words, the situation that we have in School District 9 and School District 13 is just a reciprocal
that's right.
thing, and that they've all agreed on, and it works.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. Yes. Thank you.
Steve, you wanted to point something out in the bill, clarification?
Section 10 on page 7 amends current law that deals with residency, and if you go to line 45 at the bottom of the page, it says that if you're going outside your resident district, that there still needs to be a written consent of the affected school district boards. I'm not sure if that was intended to still read that way or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Steve. Mr. Myers, I'm not sure either how that would work with the amendment, and I think that what we probably, let me see, because the amendment is actually in Section 11. That would be one of those questions that I would have to ask Legislative Council about how we rectify.
Yeah.
So, but thank you for pointing that out.
Well, and I even wonder without the amendment where you have on page 1, line 13, a school district shall contractually establish. That seems to be pretty mandatory. So I'm just wondering if that may have been something even in the initial draft that would still need to be reconciled.
Okay, that's a very good point. Thank you.
Representative Barnhart, you had a question.
Yeah, thank you. It's on a slightly different topic.
Still to the bill?
It's on the bill. Absolutely. I'm looking at section 4, sub 3 on lines 18 through 25 on page 2. I haven't parsed this well enough yet to be sure that I understand the point, but I guess the question I'm asking, if I understand this correctly, what you're doing is establishing a count as of September 1st.
Correct.
And I know that there are a number of schools, including a number of schools in the districts that I'm most familiar with, where there is huge turnover during the school year of students. There's one elementary school, for example, in Eugene, where the turnover is at least 200%. Now, there are other schools in which the turnover is 1%. It just happens the way that the thing is set up. If I read this correctly, the count as of September 1st freezes the ADM, the payment for the year. And I'm wondering if there's any provision in the bill to deal with the fact that a lot of students are mobile. And the second point, part of the question really is, what do you do with situations in which parents don't get there by September 1st? There are a lot of lackadaisical parents who kind of wander in around September 15th with their student.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, thank you for the question. Again, a very good question, and these are things that I have to admit I didn't pick up in the original drafting. But I think that and going along with an amendment that I've been working on is in relation to this is that I would prefer to see two times a year where a count is turned into the state or a census is turned into the state once and actually I would adjust that to November 1 and March 1 would be the two dates, and the reason is for exactly the reason that you've talked about is the fact that the census is going to change. Some districts have a huge turnover and some districts don't have any turnover, and we would want to make sure that the payment that the districts are receiving in the state school fund would reflect that.
I think we did see in the Eco Northwest study the different ways they showed how you count students, some pretty dramatic differences at points in time during the year that can show up.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I would point out that I think the November 1 would be an actual registration where the parent goes and registers with the district. The March 1 would be a count by the district of who has moved in and out and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to clarify that, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Representative Krummel? If not, let me recess the hearing then on that. I see we have a couple of other witnesses to testify, so I will not close, but I will recess and thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
And Representative Morgan must anticipate that we are going to 2923 next, probably because I told her we would. So we will. 2923, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2923. Steve, do you want? I skipped you last time. I apologize for that. I was in such a rush. Do you want to speak quickly on this before we go to Representative Morgan?
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2923 changes a date in the statute, and that date refers to the qualification of a public charter school as a small high school. And currently, the small high school, it would change the number of weights for that small high school in the school equalization formula. And make it easier for districts between July 18, 1995 and October 23, 1999 to qualify for those small school weights.
With that,
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Susan Morgan, State Representative from District 2, which is Douglas County and parts of Josephine and Jackson County, and I'm here today to testify on behalf of the bill, and I think in a nutshell what it does is it transfers the small school correction over to a school that becomes a charter school. And I have behind me Steve Shavero, who's the superintendent of the Dace Creek School District, that will come forward when you reopen the hearing and talk to you about it. You have, I hope, in your paper pile this morning, a letter from the Oregon Department of Education that appears to say that the transfer can be made without any kind of statute change. So I'd like to make sure that gets laid on the table and that's part of the discussion. And what I would appreciate doing is having the opportunity to go down to Legislative Council and check with Cindy to make sure that this can indeed be done by whatever mechanism the Department of Education has identified to do it. So if you would be so kind as to just hold the bill until we had an opportunity to have that conversation, I would much appreciate it.
You mean you don't want us to work it today? All right, we will be glad to do that for you. Questions for Representative Morgan? Is An Nguyen here today? No, okay.
Brian's here for the department.
Oh, Brian, you're here for the department. Are you going to testify on this bill, Brian? Or you are, okay. Well, thank you very much. In fact, are there any other members here? Let's go ahead and finish the hearing on this then, and so we'll bring up your superintendent. If you would like to come up, Mr.
Shavero,
that's it. Okay, thanks. And Mr. Herbert, do you want to come up too?
Mr. Chair, with your kind indulgence, I'll make my exit.
You bet. Thank you for joining us. As we're getting organized here, let me also just mention keeping the agenda under control, at least trying today. Show of hands, is anyone here to testify on House Bill 3079 today? Okay, the proponents have asked to have that withdrawn, so we'll not be going to hearing on House Bill 3079. So just if somebody was here to testify, would open it for that purpose. But if not, then we'll just not hear 3079. Okay, back to 3923. You want to go ahead, Mr. Shaviro?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as a small school superintendent.
I'm sorry, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, excuse me. For the record, my name is Steve Shaviro. I'm superintendent at Days Creek School in Southern Douglas County. And I would just like to take a brief moment to thank the committee for allowing me this opportunity. And I also would like to thank the committee as a superintendent of a small district for all the work that you do. And I'm sure as difficult in economic times as anybody has seen, at least I've seen in my lifetime. And we appreciate, from my heart, I appreciate all the work the legislature has tried to do over the last year and a half. I also want to thank very briefly Representative Morgan. She's been very dedicated to rural schools in Douglas County, and without her help, I wouldn't be here. When this legislation was written, 2923, our school was looking at survival, and of course we still are, as many small rural schools are. Part of that survival was taking a look at becoming a rural district-wide charter school. And in that process, there was two reasons for that. One was, and I think hopefully the most important reason was, is that the school needed to be revitalized, as many schools do. And the education component and the federal money in this grant would allow us to do that. But the second component, very honestly, is that, as many small schools have done, our cash carryover ending fund balance has dropped from $400,000 to less than $100,000 in the last 3 years. And the $300,000 that's available in the grant allows us, hopefully, survival. Now, that being said, we took a look, and as we were discussing this bill and the whole charter school concept, we spoke with people from the OSBA who gave us the best information that they had, and people from the ODE who also gave us the best information they had. And at that time, it appeared that if, in fact, according to this law, according to the ORS 327077, that if, in fact, we became a charter school, we would lose the small school correction. For our district, that's a $300,000 loss, and obviously that doesn't work. So very briefly, just for the record, I would like to, because I think it is important, would like to go over some of the history of the small school correction. Like I said, it'll be very brief. In 1993, the small school correction stated that all high schools had to be at least 15 miles from the nearest school in order to be eligible for the correction. In 93 to 95, the ODE was asked by the legislature to check to see and make sure that all schools actually were reporting the correct mileage. Al Shannon, then of the ODE, in approximately 1994, measured the miles from Days Creek High School to South Umpqua, which is the nearest high school, and the measurement came to 14.94 miles. And so at that moment, then, Days Creek did not qualify for the small school correction. And this was a loss in revenue in the vicinity of $300,000 to the school. Obviously, in 95, the ODE looked at it and I think called it the Days Creek Cliff Effect, and understood that less than one-tenth of a mile for costing the school $300,000 a year was not reasonable. In 1995, the new legislation changed the small school correction, and they changed it to 10 miles, and you would receive partial money and then the funding for the small school correction, and 20 miles, you would receive full funding. Days Creek received partial funding, but of course, as happens sometimes, new cliffs appeared. And so the legislature then took a look at that, and in October 1999, the state dropped the mileage requirement, replacing it with an ADM requirement of 350 students. So all schools of under 350, no matter the distance from the next school, then qualified under small school correction. Now, and I believe that's when ORS 327077 came into effect. In July 18, 1995, there was an establishment clause, and this established and said, and I believe it was in order to prevent charter schools in urban areas from popping up and claiming the right to the small school correction. And so it said that if you had not been a small school, not received small school funding, in July 18 of 1995, if in fact you became a charter school, you were not eligible for that funding. My understanding is
is that for a long time, and in fact the community's understanding was, that Dade Creek District Number 15 was not qualified for school, small school status on July 18, 1995. And this has been much, much maligned in my community. Our fear then was, obviously, if we became a small a district charter school, we would lose this funding. And conversations with the ODE and the OSBA, as I said, were inconclusive. So the legislature had already started and asked Representative Williams to please present a bill to help clarify this, and she was very gracious in doing that. Yesterday, and this is how the legislative process, in my opinion, works, and works so well. Yesterday at approximately 4 o'clock, received information.
Discovery.
Yeah. that received assurances from two very, very good people in the ODE, Walter Kosher and An Nguyen, that indeed the ODE, upon review, Dade Creek School District and similar small schools would in fact continue to be eligible, and we were eligible in that July 18th, 1995. And so with that, as I said, it was very late in the afternoon. We found out that through this letter that I know that Representative Morgan's checking out to make sure everything's fine, that it appears that we would not need a change in the law because it appears that we're okay. And as I said, I can't even tell you how much I appreciate this chance to visit with you guys in this whole process, because for our small little school, this was huge. This is a matter of survival or not.
Well, we're happy to look at it, and happier still if we don't need to change the law, I guess. Any questions for Superintendent Shipley?
Sure.
Representative Barnhart?
Could you give us a thumbnail of why it is you're talking about switching from a, I'm not sure what the word is even, regular public school into a charter school? What the, you know, give us just a few seconds on what the considerations are for you.
Chairman Shetterly and Representative Barnhart would be very happy to do that. And in reality, and being exceedingly honest in this, there are two reasons. One is that our school, as many small schools and many schools maybe in the state, needs educational reform, and there's not enough money right now for us to be able to have the in-depth educational reform we need. And under the charter school law, there's $50,000 in a startup grant that would allow us to take a look and see what does work in the state, what works in the nation, because this is my second year there, and I will not continue to be at a school that does not exceed state standards, and we've come a long ways. And there's excellent staff, and the community really wants that. The second one, to be, again, exceedingly honest, is that under the federal grant, there's $300,000, $150,000 a year for 2 years. And in our school, when our ending fund balance is under $100,000, that $150,000 allows us to free up other money, enabling us to continue to operate the school.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many students are in Dade Creek High School?
Chair and Representative Hobson, there's approximately right now, as a lot of schools were declining enrollment, it's approximately 220 students, K-12.
A follow-up, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair? And as it currently stands with the new understanding and new information, Dade Creek High School receives an additional $300,000 from basic school for the high school?
And Chairman and Representative Hobson, actually it's a little bit more. I think the exact amount last year was approximately $326,000, but I'd have to check that.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Mr. Herbert, welcome.
Hey. I want to echo some of the things that the superintendent has said. You know,
if you could introduce yourself.
My name is Dr. Bruce Herbert. I'm from Florence. I'm part of a group that's working to establish a charter high school, an area called Forest Lakes High School. Hmm. And a number of the issues that the superintendent talked about are there. We believe that, in fact, because of the challenges of starting small rural charter high schools, that some considerations through the small school allocation are called for. We certainly don't want to do anything to get in the way of the bill. We certainly agree that Dade Creek needs all the money it can get, and it uses it well and has a great reputation. In the process of developing our school, one of the things that we found is that because of the finance situation being what it is, it's an extremely challenging process. one of the things that we found is that we have a severe financial disadvantage relative to, quote, regular public schools of similar size who receive a small school allocation. They have extra money to cover instructional costs. They give them subject matter specialists. They have no greater needs for instructional technology or administrative expenses necessarily, but they get additional money through the small school allocation. A good example, Mapleton High School, which is about 15 miles away from us, has about 20 more students than we're projecting. We're projecting to open with about 55 to 60 kids. Because of their small high school allocation, they have 7 FTE faculty plus a full-time technology coordinator and several classified staff. We're projecting 2.5 FTE faculty, a one-quarter time administrator, a half-time secretary, and no teacher's aides. Now, one of the things that was pointed out in the talk about the small school allocation was the worry about allowing urban charter school or urban school districts to establish charter schools that would allow them to claim a small school allocation. And we certainly believe that that's something that shouldn't happen. That's a legitimate concern, and because of some of the benefits that schools in urban areas have, we think that would not be called for. It's quite a bit easier to initiate and operate charter schools in urban areas. The universe of potential students is much larger, and knowledgeable teachers, partly because there are colleges around and partly because the population is larger, are more readily available, including those who can be plugged in on a part-time basis. It's also a fact that in urban communities, incomes are higher and there's more wherewithal on the part of parents and supporters to help finance the charter school. The three counties showing the greatest income on tax returns in the state are Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties, of course, where most of the population is. Parents in those areas are more able to provide money, plus they get more help from foundations. You know, there are two main foundations that help with charter school financing. One is the Walton Foundation, from the Walmart funds, and the other is the Challenge Foundation. And we've been in contact with both of those. The Walton Foundation, whose funds obviously come from a company who made its reputation dealing with small towns, elects to put its charter school money in Oregon into only one area, and that's in Portland. That's quite a substantial amount of money. And schools in the Portland area are free to get that and do on a regular basis. We don't have any access to it. The Challenge Foundation, which also makes available millions of dollars of funds, has one currently operating grant in Oregon, and that's in Portland. So for us, there are foundations around. Most of them simply want to keep their money close to home, and that's understandable. But it makes it much more difficult for those of us who are establishing small rural charter high schools that aren't district-sponsored, in this case, which is another element of our proposal, to get the funds we need and to operate and provide the educational opportunities that we think kids should have so that we're operating on a sort of equal basis. And we know we're not going to have quite equal funds, but we think it ought to be closer to equal than it is right now. One of the things you can look at in this situation is to examine the market response to Oregon's current charter school law. We've been in operation now for 4 years, and we get a pretty good idea of where people think it's feasible to start a charter school and where it isn't. According to the State Department of Education website, there are 23 currently operating charter schools in Oregon. I know there are about 35 more or so that are on the drawing board. 17 of those are in the Willamette Valley and Portland metro areas. 17 of the 23 are also charter elementary schools. Okay. Of the 6 high school programs, 3 of them are in rural areas. However, in only one case, and that's Lincoln City Career Tech High School, is the local district not the employer. Okay. So in other words, there's only one current rural charter high school currently in operation whose impetus didn't come from the local school district. Yeah. I checked with the Oregon Department of Education about programs like ours, that are comprehensive high schools in rural areas. Outside of Eddyville, a school that is supposed to be K-12 and was a K-12 school for many years in the Lincoln County School District, where I taught for over 20 years, there are virtually no such projects moving forward other than ours. If charter schools are to provide the innovation and competition that they were intended to provide in any place besides our largest and wealthiest communities, the lack of small rural charter high schools, or then we're going to have some kind of an adjustment. And we think that the extension in a very limited fashion of the small school allocation based on the amendments that we're going to propose, and we have a legislator who's approved taking those down to the Legislative Council's office and drafting those, is called for. And we certainly hope that you will take a long and thoughtful look at those this time, at least give them some discussion so that we can address some of the problems. I think, as I say, the market response right now is that clearly it's not feasible for the most part to provide comprehensive high school programs in rural areas.
Okay. Questions for Dr. Herbert? I just hope you have it hitched your car to a train that may not be leaving the station.
it was the only bill. We're going to hear the bill, but it was too late. It was the only one that was available.
Any questions for Dr. Herbert? Okay, thanks for coming up today, both of you.
Thank you.
Brian Reeder, do you want to speak on this? Does it look like we don't need a bill?
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, I'm Brian Reeder from the Department of Education. In addressing the Days Creek issue, I think we don't need a bill. There was some misunderstanding about whether Days Creek did qualify back at the cutoff date in 1995. We have established that they did and were receiving small school correction payments at that time. So if they were to convert to a charter school, they would continue to qualify. In that sense, we don't need this bill. I haven't seen the amendments proposed, so I can't address those. But in terms of fixing the Days Creek situation, we don't need a bill.
Okay. That's what we wanted to hear. Thank you very much. With that, anybody else here to testify on 2923? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2923. And we'll go back to, are you here on 2486 for Representative Nelson? Does she want to come down?
I don't believe she'll be here, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'm not certain if my daughter believes she will.
Do we have anybody else testify and sign up? No, we don't. Let's go ahead and take your testimony then on 2486. Is that you too? Oh, wait. Okay, wait a minute. Let me do this then, just for staff management purposes. You are here on 2819 still. Okay, let's go back and finish that one while you're here, Steve. I know you guys just love to hang out in the hearing room, but you might have something more productive to do back in your office. Let's reopen the hearing on House Bill 2918 then to finish the testimony on that. And let me just find
Mr. Chair, is that 2819?
2819, thank you. A little bit trouble reading numbers, but at least I don't get lost finding my chair on my way back to the coffee pot. It was too bad. He just found his chair, then had to leave. Representative Farr, he sat down in Representative Hass's chair when he went back. Mr. Barner, Representative Barner, had to ask him if he'd intended to switch chairs. Okay. 2819, we're back in testimony on that. Let's bring up William and Catherine Lay. Are you together? Are you two together? Okay. Yeah, you are. Okay, come on up. Pioneer Youth Corps and League of Oregon Charter Schools. Okay, here we go. And welcome to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. I am very concerned about House Bill 2819, and it was a very interesting morning. I was listening to some of the testimony and was thinking, wow, you know, we've resolved one of my major concerns until I sat down and I read the amendment. Now I'm afraid I'm more concerned than I was when I started. The two things that, let me back up, please. And my name is William Lay. I'm the executive director for the Pioneer Youth Corps of Oregon. The Pioneer Youth Corps operates a special purpose charter school that works with at-risk and marginalized youth in middle schools and high school. We are currently operating in Eugene. And we serve students who, for a variety of reasons, are unsuccessful in traditional public school systems. We have been in existence for about 10 years now, but it's only been within the last 3 years that we have been we have added a charter school to our program. In 1997, we added an alternative education program at the request of many of the school districts that we were working with. We started out as an after-school program, and we were working with gang students. We were working with kids who were basically in trouble. We did a good enough job that many of the districts that we worked with asked us to add an education piece. And we did that in 1997, and we were very successful at it. We continued to grow. And in 1999, when the legislature introduced Senate Bill 100, and we applied to be one of the first charter schools, and we were one of the first five. The reason I gave you that history is because this bill concerns me on two different levels. One, it concerns me because of the rights of parents to choose. As I read through this bill, the way it reads is that the districts are going to have the right to say whether a student attends a charter school or not. We already have that restriction on alternative education programs. And if we look back here on page 5, line 4, where it adds again, when necessary to meet a student's education needs and interests, the parent or guardian, with the approval of the residential district or the resident district, may attend. And then I heard about this amendment that we were talking about, and I thought, wow, somebody thought about this and is concerned with parent choice and is going to amend this bill so that parents can choose to move their children if they decide that that's important for them to do so. But when I read over this amendment, apparently the restriction is limited to moving the student only when the residential district has basically bad grades, is not doing well. Then that's the only option that a parent can move a student out of a district that's not doing well into another school. This worries me a great deal because the idea behind the charter school movement is choice. It gives the parent the option to decide whether or not their student needs something more than they're getting in their district school. It gives the parent the right to make an opinion about their student's education. Now, I'm not speaking for all the charter schools. I'm not a lobbyist and I'm not an educator. I'm only speaking for my own school, but I do know that these things affect all the other charter schools that I have had contact with. For my particular school, many of the students who attend here, the majority of the students who attend here, are attending in my school because for a variety of reasons, they are unsuccessful in traditional public schools. And the reason that we started a charter school was, and we were very successful as an alternative ed program, we were at the time serving some 13 different school districts throughout the county, but we were backing up a waiting list. We had 57 students in 1999 who wanted to enroll in our alternative ed program, but they could not get a referral from their district. One student comes to mind in particular who was not getting in a tremendous amount of trouble, but wanted to attend the kind of program that we have and deliberately went out and tried to get arrested so that her district would give her a referral so that she could attend our school. When the state opened the option of charter schools, we saw that as an opportunity to expand the availability of our program to parents who wanted to make that kind of decision for their child. And now what we're doing is we're looking like we're going to reverse that whole thing. We're going to go right back to where we were before. I am a proponent of charter schools basically because I feel like one of the big mistakes we've made with alternative ed programs is inserting that requirement in there that you have to have the district approval in order to move your child into a program that you feel would do better for him. And here we are repeating the same mistake with charter schools. We're adding that same option in there. I have had a number of people email me and talk to me about this bill. And one of the things that the parents are saying across the board is, what's the matter? Doesn't the legislator think that I have my students' best interest in mind? Don't they think that I have the right to decide where my child goes and what kind of school my child will function best in? What right has the district to tell me whether or not I can attend a school? Now, I realize that in many cases that's a little bit harsh because I do work with a lot of the districts, and I know that the district people have the best interest of their students at heart. And I do know that in many cases the district would approve a movement. But in some cases, they would not. And in cases where it is important that a student get the services that a program like mine offers in a timely manner, these kind of things can be held up for a variety of reasons. One of the things that we run into, particularly in our school, we're a military academy. We're not a boot camp. We're not like the program over in Bend. We are a full-fledged military academy and a Tier 1 school. And ordinarily, military academies would only be available to those people who could afford to send their children to a school like ours. So basically what this is doing is this is bringing back a restriction where the only people who are going to have any type of choice as to where their child attends is those people who can afford to send them to a school that they can afford to pay for. Because there's a specific ruling right in here that says that if you can afford to pay for, if you can afford to pay tuition, then you get to go. This flies in the face of the whole concept of charter schools, the whole purpose of why charter schools were started, to give parents choice, to give people options, to allow parents to make some decisions about the education of their students without the intervention of the state, without the intervention of the government. The other thing that I'm concerned about is, and I'm saving this for last because it's a very small concern, but it comes back to money. The way this bill is set up is, and I know a lot of people are going to say, well, this really doesn't control charter schools. Yes, it does, because what it does is it controls the flow of funds. It restricts the funds down from where it is currently, 80% from elementary and middle school kids and 95% to high school kids. Charter schools right now are receiving roughly about 50% of what school districts are getting if you consider all the funding that school districts receive. We only get 80% and 95% of the base rate of the ADM. But there is other funds that districts are permitted to get that we can't tap into. We can't touch them. So we've had several accountants look at this, and they come up with a figure somewhere between about 50 and 53% of what charter schools are receiving under the current law. And if you reduce that down from at the high school level, and the majority of the kids who go to my school are high school kids, you reduce that down from 95 to 80%, I don't know where I'm going to be. I haven't done the new figures, but it's going to be below 50%. So what you're doing is in effect, you're cutting back the ability and the right of people to make choice about their kids by controlling the money. And it's a very old way of approaching this, but it's very effective.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Let's hear from Ms. Lay, and then we'll see if there are any questions.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Catherine Lay, and I'm the League of Oregon Charter Schools president. And I'm very concerned as well about House Bill 2819 for the same reasons as Mr. Lay presented. I, too, am a charter school operator and addition to being the league president, and I have talked to many of the charter schools and a lot of parents about their concerns over this bill. As the parents who have reported to me, they are concerned that these referrals are going to restrict their ability, as Mr. Lay said, to have access to the schools of choice. I'm going to paint a word picture for you and let you see. Say that September 1 remains on this bill and it's not November. They walk into their school district prior to September 1 and enroll their student and ask for a referral to a charter school. That referral the districts may not want to give a referral to a charter school. So that referral will sit on desk number one for a week, desk number two for another week, and it'll get passed down, as some of our parents have claimed to us and said that they actually had to threaten their resident districts to get a referral to come to our school because their kid was kicked out of school because of one infraction or another, and nobody else would take them in. Well, what happened is I can see the bureaucracy blooming in the fall. You're going to have districts that are going to have, we have 150 kids in our school. Say, I think there's about 450 in all of Eugene. If all 150 plus parents have to walk over to District 4J in the September to register their kids and hand in their referral papers saying, I want my kid, that's about, just estimate next year 600. How many staff are the district going to have to add that they don't have to add right now to accommodate those? How long is it going to take for those referrals to get processed? School starts September 3rd. We have 600 referrals, say, handed in the late August, early September. They have 600 referrals in the process, and it takes 6 weeks, 8 weeks to get these processed. Even if they allow them to go forward to these charter schools or alt-ed programs, we have kids sitting there either forced to go to a school that they don't choose to go to or waiting for 68 weeks. What purpose does that serve? We have kids sitting on the street, sitting at home, and parents going crazy trying to monitor their children's behavior in those 68 weeks. Then there comes a scenario. There are some parents who will be concerned enough to basically put their kids in district schools and wait for their referrals. You've got a kid who started in school for 6 weeks. All of a sudden, if they want to go where they want to go, they have to pick up their books and hat and walk to their charter school and start a whole new process all over again. We all know transition is wonderful. Yeah. Transitioning from one school to another, especially with kids as vulnerable as those who go to the Pioneer Youth Corps. Transition, change is not easy. You're looking at elementary kids for many charter schools. I think we're one of a very few high school, middle school combinations as far as a charter school is concerned. You have a lot of elementary kids. They need those first 4 weeks of school. I don't think the district, any district, is going to want the level of bureaucracy this is going to create. I don't think the parents are going to be very happy about this either. Like I said, I've had parents that have basically got their right to bring their students to our school by threatening their districts with a lawsuit to allow them to get a referral. I can see what happens when the districts who don't want to refer kids out start seeing complaints from parents. September 18th board meeting is going to be a nightmare because they're going to have a bunch of parents standing there before them saying, where are our referrals? And then down the lane, if they don't get them, there may be some parents out there that are going to say to themselves, let's form a class action lawsuit and sue the school district and sue the state and sue, because there are a few litigious-minded folks out there that have middle income. But then on the other end, there's the less affluent parents. Charter schools are mainly comprised of middle and lower income families. Somebody said once that charter schools is a privatization for the lower classes, of privatization of education for the lower classes. Is it true? I hate to admit it, but it is. We have predominantly middle and lower income families who could not send their child to a military academy, who could not send their child to a Montessori school or to a Waldorf model school. And all these options would be denied these kids because in these times of economic austerity where school district budgets are so darn tight that they are afraid of losing students, do you think they're going to be willing to give up students? We've had to fight to get students into our school, or our parents have had to fight. This is throwing
good money after bad.
Well, I think we have a sense of your inclination toward the bill.
I can't make it any plainer, but I think the restrictions,
sir. Be sure to convey that to Representative Crummell. Yeah, well, thank you very much. Do we have questions for either of these witnesses? Okay, thanks for coming in today to testify. We have one more witness signed up on this bill, Ms. Brigado.
Morning, Chair Shedley and members of the committee. My name is Nicole Brigado. I'm here on behalf of Representative Zahner, District 22, and I just want to speak primarily to the Dash 1 amendment proposal. Representative Zahner, as you know, is from a district which includes Woodburn and Jervis, and both of those districts being very small, having only one high school, and so that's the reason for these amendments. What the Dash 1 amendments would do is allow a student to be considered a resident of a district in which they do not live when the district in which they do live has failed, and this means that they are below the standard state assessments by a particular percentage. And I know the amendments right now say 10%, and Representative Crummell and I have spoken about this as to how we can make this work better. And we did do this very narrowly because we wanted to make sure that at least we could take some baby steps towards improving parental choice when school districts are failing. There are other reasons why kids would want to transfer out of school, such as unsafe conditions, which we are experiencing in some of our school districts in District 22 also. But at this time, we just want to focus on the fact that some school districts are failing, and the kids do not have a choice, and the parents do not have a choice to transfer them into another district without having to pay a tuition to the non-resident district. By allowing them to be considered residents of the other districts, then the funding would follow them. Representative Crummell touched on this a bit. His districts have done this, and his school districts have done this, and Jervis and Woodburn have both done this. As they've closed their borders to the extent that they will allow students to transfer out of their district upon with written consent, but they will not allow the money to follow that student. And the amendments would allow the student to transfer out without consent based on the fact that these schools are failing. And if we consider the federal laws are saying that no child should be left behind, and that failing schools in the federal law, if the school is failing, then the student has the option of transferring to another school within the district. Well, in Oregon, we have 107 school districts that are very small, having under 999 students, and Jervis and Woodburn being two of those. And they don't have, at least at the middle school and high school level, they don't have another school inside their district in which they can transfer and the school district keep the money. And so that's why it's so important that they be allowed the opportunity to transfer out and have the money follow them. You should have received some written testimony from one of Representative Zahner's constituents. Her name is Audrey Sweat. And attached to her testimony is a copy of the Jervis School District report card along with a comparable school district of Silver Falls. And you can see the dramatic percentage difference in what Jervis is achieving and what the state standards are. And with that, if you have any questions for me, we just think it's very important that we at least take this step to allow students to transfer out and have the money follow them.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Brigado? Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible that there could be a discussion when all the students choose to go to Woodburn and Silverton rather than Jervis that the districts could then merge?
Chair Shirley, Representative Hobson, that has been discussed that we would actually, if Jervis is so bad, that it could actually merge into one of the neighboring school districts. And right now we're having a lot of resistance from the Jervis School Board, needless to say. So that's one of the reasons why we haven't proposed that at this time. But, the representative is working with the community on it.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd just point out that both Representative Hobson and I have co-sponsored a piece of legislation that will call for a fairly significant review of school district operations. There are about 198 of them, and recommend, hopefully, a balanced plan for reorganization, which in many cases I hope will encourage additional consolidation. Obviously, we got to let the plan work, but clearly, I think there are a number of instances around the state where, but for sort of historical accident and the current political positioning by current districts, it would behoove both the students and the communities to consider some consolidation of districts. So anyway, I put that out there just for
thank you
comment.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, yes. Representative Williams, do you recall a number on that bill?
Oh, I turned to my colleague to the left. Do you remember the number?
You know what I mean?
Is that in education?
It is in Representative Backlund's committee in the education committee. Is it 2806?
I would hate to say that.
I asked the question because I'm also very interested in that topic.
Say it again, John. 3104.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
You were close.
So many numbers floating around right now. It's hard to keep
so many great numbers, so little time. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, Chair Shirley, just so you know that there was a constituent who is interested in speaking to this.
Oh, okay, well, let's have the constituent up. We'll finish the hearing on that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
I thank you all for being willing to listen to me. I want to start with
your name, please.
Oh, my name is Daniel Sell. My partner is Lori Freer. We are residents of the Jervis School District, which has just been mentioned. And I'd like to start with that Mr. and Mrs. Lee's comments. And they are right in the fact that this really doesn't protect the parents' choice of schools. It doesn't give us the right to send our children to the proper school for that particular child. But we have to start somewhere, and so we're going to support this because this is a topic that should concern anyone with kids, grandkids, nieces, nephews, any family members that are in school. In the Jervis School District, it has closed its borders completely. All transfers are denied. They do not listen to whatever the reasons are not of interest to them. They are interested in the dollar figures and the dollar figures alone. The majority of these children have never even attended the Jervis School District, and yet they're claiming that they're losing this money because these children don't attend their school. In our case, we've had two children that have gone through the Jervis School District. One went K through 8, one went K through 9. And in both cases, we pulled them out of school because of the serious threats against their well-being. Our daughter was threatened by gang violence in the Jervis High School because she happened to wear red and blue clothes to school one day. Because she happened to choose this color of clothes to wear, suddenly she was violating some gang's territorial colors. Our son was threatened, his life was threatened in front of a school staff member. Nothing happened in either case. In both instances, the stuff is swept underneath the rug. And it just goes away. It just disappears. Our son, we recently had his records pulled in Silverton High School because we had been constant contacts with the school. And every record of every contact that we've had with this school is gone from his records. They have been swept completely clean. The contacts concerning school issues, the contacts concerning safety issues, the contacts concerning where he got a referral or he got in trouble, everything is gone with the minor exception of so-and-so has the right to pick up Josh today. You know, those are the only things that are left in his records after 8 years in the school district. Now, and as parents, we are required to give our children an education, right? We are also required by law to protect our children. We're foster parents as well as being natural parents. We have a foster girl now. Her mother is being charged with failure to protect. She's going to have to answer that charge in court. If we send our children into a school where their lives have been threatened or In our son's case, he came home with a huge bruise on his arm. If we send our child to that school, are we not failing to protect our children? And under the No Child Left Behind Act, a school in Jervis's condition, where they claim they're short on money to be able to improve anything, they're short, they can't deal with the gangs, or in Jervis's case, if you talk to the mayor, they say there's a major gang problem. If you talk to the school, it says there's no safety issues. They went on TV and stated there are no safety issues in Jervis. And yet if you talk to the mayor or the police chief in Jervis, there are huge gang problems and there are huge safety issues in the school. Under the No Child Left Behind Act, if they fail to meet the state standards, whatever the standards are set for the No Child Left Behind Act, for 3 years running, they are eligible to receive federal grants in order to help them clean up their problem. The federal grant money will be applied for their bringing people in to teach them what to do about the gang situation, how to bring their grade levels up, how to bring up their safety issues. There's a lot of things to be gained by it. Unfortunately, it's obvious that we're not going to get the parental choice that we should have. And in our case, when we take a foster child in, sometimes they come from extremely bad situations, and we have to have a school that is willing to communicate and work with us with these children. If the child starts acting behave bad in school and we don't know about it, the next thing you know, there's F's and D's and all kinds of problems at school that we never had a chance to deal with. This is what happened with our son in Jervis. We can't afford to let this happen with the foster children that we take in. We've been working with the St. Paul School District, which is a very small school, and it has the principal superintendent. It also happens to be a foster adoptive parent. So he's familiar with the problems that we face when we take some of these children into our home. Our present one that we just took in, we just finished adopting one. We just took another one in. She has real safety issues. She was molested. She was beaten. The school understands that. If there's any problems whatsoever, they contact us, let us know. We go down to the school. We work out the problems and deal with it. In Jervis, we never even heard about things until it was so darn late that there was nothing we could do about it. So we do have to testify on behalf of this bill because we have to start somewhere. And if this school can be declared to be a failing school district, then that will give us the right to choose. Our personal belief is that we should have that right to choose all the time. If the school is best for this foster child, then we should be able to send that foster child. It is a state kid. For all intents and purposes, it's a state child. The parents are the state of Oregon. We're just acting as substitute parents for the state of Oregon. Okay, does the state of Oregon, does that mean Salem? Should all children that are foster children be required to go to school in Salem? Or should they be required, if they're from Lincoln County, does that mean that we should transport them to Lincoln County? I mean, this is a choice that should be left in the hands of DHS and the foster parents. All we're asking is do the best you can to keep the borders open in Oregon. The school should not have the right to unilaterally close their borders and deny all transfers, irregardless of the reasons behind it. Whether it's a safety issue, whether it's a schooling issue, whatever the issues, the school should not have the right to close their borders and deny the parents the choice to send their children to a good school that is safe. Thank you.
Interesting bill. Your testimony in favor of the bill is pretty much the same as the Lay's in opposition to the bill. I guess it's a bill that can be all things to all people.
Well, we're in on the amendment.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Let me close the public hearing then on House Bill 2819. Yeah. And I think we already finished 2923. Let me pick up 2486, then we'll come back and finish 45. I think we may not be getting to 3271 today, unless Representative Krupp comes back. He said they may be able to work that out. So unless he comes in, we won't actually take it. Is anyone here to testify on 3271? Okay. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2486. Lizbeth, and while you're doing that, you're it? Except for the Revenue Coalition. It's going to fly over here in a minute. But
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2486, This creates a new personal income tax credit for the amount of the interest paid on debt incurred to purchase goods and services for personal, family, or household purposes. Mm-hmm. It limits the credit, but that is yet to be determined. There are blanks in the bill. It restricts the credit to not exceed the taxpayer's tax liability and may not be carried forward. It allows the tax credit to just one spouse of the married couples filing on separate returns and applies to the amounts of interest in tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2004. So just for your information, this is Representative Nelson's bill, and I did some work for her over the interim on this issue, so I've given you a table here, which is, you know, would help give you at least an understanding of the magnitude of this revenue impact, depending on what percentage you put in there for the amount of interest that would be claimed as a credit. And so as you can see, like 1%, if you had 1% of the amount of interest that was paid in a year, that would be roughly in 2004, $8.6 million, and it goes up from there.
Okay. Matthew, oh, there you are.
Hey,
well, Matt, you were in judiciary for your boss yesterday, and now you're in revenue, a man for all seasons.
My apologies, Mr. Chair. I'm no Representative Nelson.
Okay.
How was that line? I knew Representative Nelson, and you, sir, are no Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Matt Metter. I work for Representative Nelson, and I will read her testimony verbatim today on House Bill 2486. In the current economic climate, it is essential that consumers be provided some measure of relief. House Bill 2486 restores a tax credit for consumer debt that was revoked some years ago. More specifically, House Bill 2486 establishes a tax credit for interest assessed to taxpayers on debt incurred to purchase goods and services for personal, family, or household purposes. The bill becomes effective in January 2004. Nationally, consumers are well over $6 billion in debt. In recent years, this number has grown substantially. But consumer spending accounts for two-thirds of all economic activity in the United States. Americans' incomes, including wages, interest, and government benefits, rose by a solid 0.4% in December, up from a 0.3% rise the month before. Income growth is important because it provides the fuel for future spending. Incidentally, those figures were better than had been predicted. One major driver of the growing debt burden is credit cards, which have become easier to get than ever. Stemming primarily from the low interest rate environment and an intensive marketing effort by credit card issuers, the growth in the number of credit cards in circulation has been astronomical. By the end of 1996, for example, there were more than 553 million bank credit cards, in circulation in the nation, or 2.1 cards for every man, woman, and child. Credit card issuers sent off 2.7 billion offers per year through the last decade, many of them from the pre-approved variety. As a result of the heavy marketing efforts by issuers, credit card purchases in the United States topped the $870 billion mark in 1996. The ease of obtaining credit has left the American consumer in a precarious position. Not only has total outstanding short and intermediate term consumer credit debt reached an all-time high, but total revolving credit outstanding debt also has reached a record high proportion of nearly 40%. How does this credit explosion affect the American family? By the mid-90s, credit card balances had grown to 3.7% of the average family debt burden. Although that is a relatively small proportion of total debt, its continued growth remains a concern because of the high interest rate nature of credit card debt. House Bill 2486 is a tax credit for such consumer debt. By placing the hard-earned income of the taxpayer back in the taxpayer's hands, this bill will help jumpstart Oregon's precarious economy. Chair Shetterly, and members of the committee, I urge you to support this bill on behalf of Representative Nelson.
You do that well. You ever consider a career in radio?
Thank you, Representative. You can hook him up with Representative's honor.
Yeah. Any questions for Matt? All right, thank you very much. I see we also have a letter in the bill in support of the bill in the file from Oregon Auto Dealers Association, and they say, thank you for your interest. I wonder if they intended that as a pun.
It says it's in the letter.
It's in the letter. What can they say? Thank you for your interest. At least they didn't give us credit for hearing the
And it's only April.
Lori Wimmer Whalen, did you want to fly over here now? Okay.
Leaf for the drop.
Surrender Dorothy?
Little dog Toto, too. Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Revenue Coalition today, and I apologize, I was behind the eight ball, so I will not have a drive-by for you, which is why I'm at the mic. Just to register our opposition to the bill, as you might imagine, we believe that creating a tax exemption for consumer debt would not be in the state's interest. I'll note for the record that it's not means-tested, so no holds barred in this particular concept, and the Oregon Revenue Coalition, as you are well aware, opposes the creation of new tax credits, particularly if they don't meet the criteria that you've all seen the list for and if they can't be purchased or made revenue neutral by being paired with the cancellation of another existing tax credit of equal value. And we would also just remind you, as you've seen before, what $1 million would buy. And that, with that, I will wrap it up.
All right. Thank you, Lori. Wait. We might have questions. No, I guess not. Okay. Well, then, does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2486? If not, we'll close the public hearing on that. Brian Reeder, let's pick you back up on H.J.R. 45, and I think he's our last witness. Then we've got a series of taps that we'll finish out the morning with. Brian on H.J.R. 45.
Thank you, Chair Federley, members of the committee. I would just like to make some general comments about the concept behind H.J.R. 45 rather than specific comments about the bill itself. This is a bill which is similar to a number of other proposals that have been put forward that would make some fundamental changes to the way we fund schools in Oregon. As you know, right now the state controls the amount of money that districts get. We do have a small local option, but very few districts take advantage of that. So for all practical purposes, the state, the legislature decides how much money schools get. The proposals that have been discussed recently would change that and put more control back into local hands over the fundamental decision of how much money local schools get. The department supports looking into that change to the structure of our funding system. There is a fairly large amount of evidence out there that local control over funding decisions is a fundamental part of local control over schools. I think what we've seen in Oregon since the passage of Measure 5 is a fairly rapid decline in citizen involvement in school funding issues because they no longer vote on local levies. Measure 5 passed roughly 13 years ago. Since then, we've had very rapid population growth in Oregon, and I think we have a very sizable share of our population that has never voted on a school levy. They don't understand what it means to discuss locally the issue of how much money we're going to devote to our schools. I think the discussion is a very important one. Local control is one of the fundamental issues in schooling. It's a locally delivered service, and the issue of who decides how much is devoted to that service, whether it's the state or whether it's local voters, is really a fundamental issue that needs to be explored.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Brian Reeder? All right. Thank you for coming forward. Brian, we'll close the public hearing on H.J.R. 45. I had a note that Representative Krupp requested just a tap hearing on House Bill 3271, so I will open the public hearing on House Bill 3271, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3271. Then we have, am I doing something wrong? Okay. All right. Well, we'll just go through these this list of bills now and tap them in so we preserve them as vehicles or whatever purpose may be served by it. we'll see. House Bill 2629. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2629. Close the public hearing. House Bill 2629. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2630. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2630. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3052. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3052. You staying with me, Kathy? Okay. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3451. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3451. Open the public hearing on H.J.R. 27. Close the public hearing on H.J.R. 27. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3500. Anybody wish to testify?
Not at this moment, Mr. Chair, right. But I'm begging for a chance.
All right. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3500. Open the public hearing on H.J.R. 13. Close the public hearing on H.J.R. 13. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2526. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2526. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3607. That'll be a fun one. Close public hearing on House Bill 3607. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2837. Is that yours, too?
This one's going to help.
Is that yours?
Which one?
2837. Is that yours?
I think it might be my very text, okay. Yeah.
Close public hearing on House Bill 2837, then quickly. Open public hearing on House Bill 2598. Close public hearing on House Bill 2598. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2599. Close public hearing on House Bill 2599. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2601. Close public hearing on House Bill 2601. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2602. Close public hearing on House Bill 2602. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2604. And close public hearing on House Bill 2604. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3278. What? Thank you. I'll come back to that in just a second. Public hearing on House Bill 3278. Which one?
2556.
All right. For the record, we opened a public hearing on House Bill 2556, and we closed a public hearing on House Bill 2556. All right? With that, we're adjourned.